Committee to order. The time is 1:04. The date is February the 25th. Present for the record is Representative Samuels. We also have Representative Ogg, Anderson, and myself, McGuire, and Gruenberg. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We have three items on the agenda today, and they'll go in this order. The first will be House Bill number 472 regarding claims against health care providers by Representative Anderson. Then we're going to go to House Bill number 367 regarding licensing of sex-oriented businesses by myself and Representative Guerra. And then we'll go to House Bill number 424, Regulation Review, by Representative Holm. We're going to be taking public testimony in 472 and 424 and by invitation only in 367. Just to give the members and the folks here in the audience and online an idea of what we're going to do regarding the medical malpractice bill. Today will be our first hearing on the subject, and it's my intent to obviously take all the public testimony that is in the audience and online. All of the members here have received a packet of supporting documents on the bill, which is important that they read through. So we'll take the bill back up next Wednesday, and it's my intent to have only this bill up next Wednesday. So we'll devote the entire House Judiciary time period to that. And so for anybody who's online or in the room that knows of somebody who wasn't able to testify today, it'll be next Wednesday. And again, it'll be first up in the only bill. So with that, I will go to Representative Anderson. And then I've got folks in a list here to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate that you are taking the time to hear this bill, and I think it's very important. It's an important piece of legislation, probably my number one priority this year, along with another bill. House Bill 472 proposes to modify the current policy of how much a person can get so-called pain and suffering in medical liability cases. And specifically, I am proposing we establish a hard cap of $250,000. It's fairly evident in the bill's language. Currently, AS 09-17010 allows for $400,000 or $8,000 times the life expectancy of the claimant, whichever is greater, for most injuries, or severe physical impairment or severe physical disfigurement. The cap amount is $1 million or $25,000 times the life expectancy, whichever is greater. Because these awards ratchet to the higher amount, these are really known as soft caps. That's the vernacular. Madam Chair, I believe that we must establish a $250,000 cap to improve the medical liability risk environment in our state. That's why I've sponsored the bill. Incidentally, as I've testified in other committees out of law school and during law school, I've worked in personal injury firms. I've dealt with a few cases such as this, and I've been there as a practitioner, and certainly can see the necessity for this. It's very timely. When medical liability insurance carriers examine a market to potentially write policies, similar to when we talked to Kevin Meyer about his bill, same idea, they take into account many factors. One of the most important factors is the likelihood of big payouts, and this has been kind of the spirit of tort law for years, and that's been the target. The current situation in Alaska regarding big payouts is uncertain, however, and this uncertainty, in my opinion, equals risk. And if you're an insurance carrier, risk is obviously something to be avoided, and that's why many insurance carriers have departed from our state, and that conflagration of departure hasn't ended. By establishing this hard cap of $250,000, we will be establishing certainty, in my opinion. And why $250,000? My staff delivered support materials to the committee members, and it's in a black loose leaf notebook. I'm sure you've all seen them. My notes here are had a forklift deliver them.
But that's just the executive summary.
This is correct. No. This is pretty much the materials we wanted you to read. Obviously, it's intensive, but it's pertinent, it's relevant, and I think it shows for myself and the individuals that are going to testify today just how important this is. I mean, we're not taking this lightly. and this wasn't drafted overnight.
Literally.
No, that's right. And as much as we can laugh, this took a lot of time.
Oh, yeah.
And these weren't indiscriminately placed in here. So if that doesn't show you the importance, at least of the people supporting the bill, I'm not sure what does. Quite simply, we really want to get health care in line with other states. We want to ensure affordable health care. This is a way to do this. I'd like to speak for just a moment about medical liability coverage. In order to protect their assets, most doctors indemnify themselves with insurance. And if a patient is unhappy with the result, most of you understand this, you can go through the courts, seek a judicial remedy, and a settlement is awarded generally, and this coverage kicks in and pays the award. But then, of course, doctors don't carry this type of policy just to protect themselves. They do it for the patient and the overall dynamic of where they work. And the result is higher healthcare coverage and insurance coverage for them. Healthcare facilities require doctors carry insurance, so this is a mandate for them to practice in these facilities. Without medical liability insurance, doctors can't go into hospitals, deliver babies, install pacemakers, replace joints, hips, whatever the case may be, let alone save lives in the emergency room. And so there's obviously a component here that affects us all and hopefully makes you think long and hard about how we restrict and require and mandate our physicians and medical practitioners carry out their profession, because I promise you it will extrapolate out to affecting us. Pass a bill like this positively, don't pass this, and continue the status quo negatively. It's critical that medical liability insurance be available for our doctors, and in my opinion, right now, it's very difficult for them to achieve this without having a hardship to the degree that they want to leave the profession. Madam Chair, just a few months ago, 4 carriers offered medical liability insurance in Alaska, and just in these last few months, we only have 2 now. So this departure, I think, is an example of what the problem is. If one of them leaves with only 2 left, we're looking at disaster, because the other carrier obviously can't handle the capacity of all the physicians in the state. And you'll hear more about this in today's testimony. In Alaska, we have a shortage of doctors, and we've talked about that. I recall 2 bills last year we talked about that problem. And certainly in Labor and Commerce, as the chairman, I can attest to legislation addressing that and having facts to that degree. And so the number of claims on these insurance policies is rising as a result of this. And there is a corollary between the two, and it's becoming severe. The Physician Insurance Association of America reports that nearly 8% of all awards now exceed $1 million. So there's a windfall, and in my opinion, not always justified. Double this 8% what it was 5 years ago. Without a hard cap, which we're pushing for in this bill, there is no reason to think that this trend will change and the problem will continue. So in conclusion, Madam Chair, I thank you for the time. Thanks for hearing my bill first. Our constituents depend on Alaska's healthcare professionals for quality health care, and that's why I sponsored the bill. Those professionals, physicians, need to be indemnified to provide that care, as I've stated. And I won't speak for your constituents on the committee, but I know my constituents and the healthcare providers are depending on us to create an environment where insurance carriers have the confidence to write these policies. And I say that facetiously. Of course, all of our constituents want this. So I'm eager to hear the testimony of individuals today, and I think you'll read off the list. But the first person I would definitely like, if you'd be so willing, Madam Chair, to hear from is Jim Jordan, the Executive Director from the Alaska State Medical Association. And what Jim will do, rather than me read verbatim my sectional description of the legislation, he'll talk about aspects of the bill, including the informed consent, not really just the abortion issues, informed consent addressed from cases Corman v. Malin, and Marzengill v. O'Malley. And if you read my sectional description, sectional analysis, I think it's fairly thorough why we have pressed for those changes to statutory law and also trying to override this court opinion. And I think this will bring clarity to the bill, and Mr. Jordan will help with that. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Okay. Okay, next I'm going to go to Jim Jordan, Executive Director of the Alaska State Medical Association.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Welcome to House Judiciary.
Thank you. I will get to Marzengill versus O'Malley and Corman versus Nallen. But before doing that, if I could gain your indulgence, and also what I would like to ask too, with the chair's approval, is if Dr. Malter could speak next, because what I'm going to talk about first has to do with the practice environment and the environment that we have in this state in regards to the recruitment of new physicians. And Representative Anderson mentioned in his remarks about our shortage. But if you'd indulge me for a moment, I'd appreciate that. For the record, I'm Jim Jordan. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska State Medical Association, and I'm testifying in that capacity today. The reason I'm mentioning that, because by way of disclosure, I also serve on the Board of Directors for the Medical Underwriters of California. And the Medical Underwriters of California is the attorney in fact, and those attorneys on the committee will know what I'm talking about. Well, an attorney in fact is a special special entity that's found in law that operates a reciprocal insurance company. And MIEC is a reciprocal insurance company. So I sit on the board of the operating company for the Medical Insurance Exchange of California. You'll be hearing testimony later from an executive representing MIEC. I would like to tell you a short story about medical care in Alaska. This story is about a patient who had a routine physical last summer. It was done by a general internist in Anchorage. That doctor, during the course of examination, discovered a suspicious tumor in the patient's lower GI tract. A hastily arranged colonoscopy, along with a biopsy, confirmed a very rare cancerous tumor, and one that is normally without symptoms. As a matter of fact, this type of cancer is typically not discovered until it has spread to the brain, heart, or lungs. The good news is that it was caught at a very early stage by a skilled physician and was successfully treated by surgical removal. So you may wonder why I'm relating this story to you that has a happy ending. For one reason, the story is very personal. The patient happens to be my wife. For another, it highlights the need in Alaska for well-trained physicians in sufficient numbers to provide the care that our citizens need and deserve. The general internist who saw my wife is Dr. Richard Neubauer, who happens to be about my age, and you can guess what my age is, regarding the gray in my hair. Dr. Neubauer graduated from Yale Medical School, did his graduate medical education at the University of Michigan, amongst other places. As I mentioned previously, he's a general internist. General internists are in very short supply in Alaska. The fall 2002 Providence study, which is in that tome, shows a shortage in Anchorage alone of 43.25 general internists on a full-time equivalent basis. And that's Anchorage alone. And I believe you're going to hear testimony that the number of general internists continues to drop in Anchorage as well as throughout the state. And the remaining general internists are overtaxed in their practices, in the emergency room call and coverage schedules, and in some cases has simply left the state to a practice that allows them to have a family life. What would have happened had Dr. Neubauer not been around for my wife, or for that fact, the surgeon, Dr. June George, who is one of only two board-certified colorectal surgeons in the entire state? Perhaps a general surgeon could have treated her, but that same Providence study also shows a deficiency of Anchorage alone of nearly 20 full-time equivalent general surgeons. The shortages are real. Dr. Neubauer and I, being contemporaries, often muse, who's going to be around and left to care for us? HB 472 is an important element in creating a practice environment that will help us recruit the doctors that we need in the state. Dr. Malter will talk more about that issue. And the hard cap on non-economics at $250,000 will set the gold standard that will help us recruit physicians. Additionally, as Representative Anderson mentioned earlier, There are two Supreme Court cases that have to do with the process of informed consent. And perhaps I should take a moment just to explain what informed consent is all about. In Alaska statute, it's required that any time a healthcare provider, which includes physicians, suggests to a patient a course of treatment, surgery, etc., that the patient must be provided with sufficient information so that patient can make an informed decision as to whether or not to proceed with that care, or to refuse the care, or to seek, you know, whatever other alternatives might be available. Corman v. Mallon was the first seminal case involving informed consent, and that case came down in 1993, and essentially it established some requirements for the process of informed consent, but did not provide any guidelines to the physicians. Then along came Marzengill versus O'Malley, which the Supreme Court rendered a judgment in fall of 2002. Again, it followed the same course as Corman v. Mallon, but again, did not provide any guidelines for the physicians to follow. In addition, in Corman v. Mallon, and this is something that raised tremendous issues in my constituency, was the circumstance involving a phone call in the middle of the night, and whereby the surgeon was asked by this patient, or was the patient presented over the telephone and indicated that she was having some problems. And the surgeon said, well, I'll either meet you at my office or you should go to the emergency room. And he said, matter of fact, I think you should go to the emergency room. And upon that interchange, the patient asked, well, will they put a nasal gastric tube? In other words, tube down your nose, down your stomach. And I'm not a physician, by the way. I'm just telling you what my bosses have explained. And that's a very uncomfortable procedure. The patient chose not to do that because she apparently had a previous bad experience with having that done. It's an uncomfortable procedure. And so several hours later, she had some medical problems, collapsed, ended up with a cerebral event, and now is very injured. In the Marzengill versus O'Malley decision, the court gave specific directions to the lower court to rehear this case involving the informed consent issue, involving the calls in the middle of the night. You may ask why that's important. And I have a rather extensive analysis written by Anchorage attorney Howard Lazar that I will offer to the committee that, you know, is much more expert in its analysis than I could ever be. But essentially, Howard Lazar, along with others, indicated that this type of potential liability could stop physicians from taking calls from patients and simply having the standing instruction go directly to the emergency room. And I think from the standpoint of patient care, that's not a good idea. I don't think any of the physicians want to, you know, have to cut off being able to take calls from their patients. So the language in HB 472 relating to the calls in the middle of the night is to respond to the issues raised in Marzengill versus O'Malley. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Dr. Malter, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I will, but before you go, Mr. Jordan, one of the thoughts I had in looking at this case, and by the way, the members have both cases now, but in the Marzengill case, what we've been trying to do on a legislative level, both federal and state, is to implement telemedicine across the state of Alaska, because we all understand the cost of healthcare delivery to rural Alaska is so expensive. you know, OBGYNs have pulled out in most of those areas, and true experts just don't exist. What impact do you think the Marcinkeel case might have on telemedicine? I mean, that was my first thought, is what if somebody, a physician, is giving an opinion via a teleconferencing system and a result occurs like what happened in this case?
Yeah, I think it would help telemedicine in that, you know, it makes it clear that that message delivered over an electronic means. You know, I think that you know, the specific language in HB 472 deals with the means, you know, electronically provided, and also deals with the, you know, with the circumstance when the message is delivered via that means and the patient chooses not to avail her or himself of that.
Representative Garrett, do you have specific questions for Mr. Jordan?
I do, though I'd actually like to go back to Representative Anderson. He said something very quickly, and I just wanted to make sure I heard it right. Representative Anderson, you were talking about something about the number of million-dollar cases and as a proportion of the overall number of cases. Was that an Alaska statistic about million-dollar cases, or was that a national statistic?
Through the chair, I believe that was a national statistic.
Mr. Jordan, I've got a few questions. I'm going to try and spread them out among witnesses, so I'm going to spare you.
Okay.
I don't have a big problem with the informed consent amendment that you guys are asking for. It seems reasonable. I do bristle a little bit about the sort of idea that it's needed because the current statute is a mess and doesn't have any standards. And, you know, the standard is very clearly stated out in the jury instructions. It says that a doctor shall give a patient information that a reasonable patient would need to make an informed decision, and that information would include information about risks and information about alternatives. But, I mean, you're right. The amendment you're proposing, I think, is needed, and I don't have a problem with it. I did have a problem with Howard Lazar's letter. It was a little bit alarmist. It did suggest to doctors that they shouldn't take calls anymore. And I had a doctor call me up, and when the doctor actually thought it through, he realized it didn't. The law really didn't require that of him, and I think Howard's letter was a little more alarmist than it needed to be. But the amendment seems responsible. Alaska has historically had a problem with doctor shortages in various areas. Isn't that fair to say? But my understanding is that the growth rate of doctors in Alaska compared to the national average is higher. That other states are losing their doctors at a higher rate than we are. Do you have any knowledge about that, how we compare to other states as to the increase in the percentage of doctors in the state?
As compared to the rest of the country, no, I don't. But I can tell you that, and Dr. Malter will speak to this, and there's specific information that he'll give you about the Alaska physician population, and that is that we have the lowest number of physicians per capita in the country.
Sure. The question about malpractice rates, which have also always been high in the state. I suppose if we're trying to link that to why doctors aren't coming up here, though I haven't heard that that's why doctors aren't coming up here, I guess the other relevant question for doctors would be how much do they get paid up here? Do you have any idea where, generally, how private practitioners in Alaska fare salary-wise to private practitioners in other states?
We don't collect that data. And in regards to the I think it was a question about the about the decision making process of a physician. We'll provide you, and it's not in the packet because we just got this, is that the American Medical Association has done a study of medical students as to, you know, what considerations come into their decision-making process and where they're going to do their residency work. And what that study has shown is that the legal environment and the availability and affordability of medical liability insurance is tantamount, is very important. And the reason why I say this is important as to the recruitment of physicians in Alaska is that we have one residency program in this state, family practice residency, and it produces 8 and I think is going to be expanded to include 10. And that, you know, that's a drop in the bucket as far as our overall, and it's only for family practice. But The further point that I would like to make is the American Medical Association has done studies over the years as to, you know, where physicians go to practice. And the last statistic I have is that 70% of residents practice where they do their residency.
Comments and just one more question.
Thank you.
Have any of the insurance companies told you that they would lower their insurance rates if we pass this bill?
No.
And I guess just in that vein, I'd like to share with you, in 1997, when the insurance companies, NorCal specifically, we just passed around a NorCal letter a couple minutes ago, NorCal specifically said we needed that round of tort reform, which was our second round of major tort reform when we limited damages. They said they needed that one because in California they had tort reform in the medical arena, and let's see, malpractice rates had gone down significantly, and so they wrote to us and said, over the long term, Alaska physicians and hospitals should see similar reductions in the cost of malpractice insurance if HB 58 is enacted and upheld by the courts. And of course, we haven't. So there, unless you can show me that malpractice insurance rates actually have gone down since we passed our tort reform bill in 1997, I've always been very bothered by that promise that was made in 1997, and I'm very skeptical that the promise would hold any water today.
May I respond?
Sure. Manager?
Okay, first of all, I'm also going to supply for the committee, and this study is in the book, but I would just pull this out so that you're aware of it. This was a study that was done by the American Academy of Actuaries in 1996, and it's called Medical Malpractice Tort Reform's Lessons from the States. And it was reported on in the American Academy's bi-monthly journal called Contingencies in January, February of 1997. And first of all, what this essentially states, and you can, you know, read it for yourself and obviously make your own, come to your own conclusions, but essentially my reading indicates that for effective medical liability reform, it's a matter of a package of reforms. It's not just, you know, any one item. And that what occurred in 1997 was part of the package. For example, the gold standard that's compared to frequently is the California MICRA law, which was enacted in 1976, and which includes a number of elements that weren't addressed in 1997. The one thing that this study by the American Academy of Actuaries indicates that one of the key elements is a cap on non-economic damages that is low enough to make a difference. And the cap in California is $250,000. And there are other elements, too, that I'm happy to go into. At least to the best of my knowledge, for example, I believe that the requirement that judgments be annuitized in California is a requirement so long as the judgment is, I think it's in excess of $50,000. Here, it's discretionary.
One last question, Madam Chair.
Representative Guerra.
I'm just going to ask my, you know, to hear somebody call the California rule the gold standard almost hurts me. because a $250,000 non-economic damages cap, and just for so folks know, non-economic damages covers the compensation that you get for pain, for suffering, for your inability to fish, for your inability to walk, for your inability to hold a child, for all those damages that are hard to measure in dollar terms, like lost wages and medical costs, but your loss of enjoyment of life essentially. The $250,000 cap that you propose for somebody with a valid claim who is badly paralyzed and has a 40-year lifespan, projected lifespan, works out to about $22 a day. Is that fair to you?
But what does it multiply out to?
Well, if you limit it to $250,000, that's about $22 a day. And I'm just wondering if that seems fair to you for somebody with a valid claim who has been badly paralyzed or otherwise very, very, very seriously and permanently harmed.
$22 a day. But that's only one element. You also haven't talked about the recompense for the economic damages. And also, too, I think what we're dealing with here with
That's really all I wanted to ask you. For their loss of their ability to walk, for the loss of their ability to fish,
right.
For their loss of their ability to carry their child, for their loss of their ability to whatever they can't do anymore, apart from their lost wages, you're right, and apart from medical costs that they don't get back. For these losses, the loss of enjoyment of life, do you think that limiting it to $22 a day for somebody with a 40-year lifespan with a severe injury, if they had a valid claim, is fair?
If I may, through the chair, I'd like to turn the question around. I think, number one, I'm going
to
make a statement, if I might, is that this is a policy decision here. And obviously, that's why we're here in having this discussion. And I think what the policy decision is do we want to have a practice environment to where we can recruit physicians in the numbers that we need that are there to treat those patients? The circumstances that you're talking about certainly are tragic. But what we're talking about is only one element of the recompense. There's no limit on the economic damages, nor have we ever suggested that. What we're recommending is that we are recommending that there be a cap on those damages that are most subjective, that are the hardest to come by. And, you know, I may say $22 is high, low, or indifferent. And I think that differs from one person to the next. The legislature, in essence, has established caps not only on non-economic damages, but on economic damages on a de facto basis in another area. Take a look at the Motor Safety Vehicle Responsibility Act. So, you know,
Just to say a general announcement about the decorum of the committee today, we're not on trial, and I appreciate the questions and the dialogue, and I try to give a lot of latitude in this committee, but I don't want members of the public that come forward to testify to feel like they're on trial. They're here today to testify in favor. They can respond to the questions you pose, Representative Guerra, or not, and I don't want to protract it on into a trial-like format. So I think you've heard the answer that Mr. Jordan's going to give you, and we have about 20 other witnesses online that will be able to offer, I think, answers in other areas that you have. I'd like to continue on with the debate if there isn't a question on a different subject that you have.
No, I still do. This is very important, Madam Chair, though. I really do want a basic element of our decision has to be, do we think this is fair? And it's certainly Mr. Jordan's option not to answer that question, but I do want to know whether or not in that circumstance I described he feels it's fair, because if it's not, then what we have to do is consider maybe having a lower non-economic damage limit for non-serious cases, which I'd be very sympathetic to, but have a higher one for very, very, very serious debilitating cases that involve severe disfigurement or severe paralysis or something like that. And so that's why I do ask if it's fair.
Sure. And ultimately, once the witnesses have testified, it will be our burden, if you will, to weigh out those policy decisions among the members of the House Judiciary Committee. And I suspect that you'll have amendments that you'll offer at the appropriate time, and that will be our time to sit as policymakers and think about that. So Representative Ogg and then Gruenberg.
Yes, Madam Chair. Just had a question. Under the present scheme, and I had conversations in my office, the number came out that under the soft cap that you have right now, that if you reach the maximum of that right now, with all the factors involved, that number is 2 million?
Could be, I think, yeah. I've seen that estimate, yes.
That's what I heard.
Yeah.
So right now we, in essence, have about a $2 million cap, and then this proposes to go down to a $200,000 cap in that category. That was the only question I had at this time.
Representative Gruenberg and then Anderson.
Very briefly, you mentioned a letter by Dr. Lazar. I don't know if it's in this large packet, but I can't find it. I wonder if you could get copies of
I have it here.
if we could give it to the staff, maybe, Joe, you could make a copy if you would.
If you would be willing. And then I didn't know the actuarial evidence that you referred to, if we could have a copy of that, as well as the something you referred to at the outset that you just received.
Oh, it was AMA survey of medical students. And
of
we
medical
have that
students. Okay, fantastic.
And I had one more.
Representative Gruenberg?
Representative Gara mentioned a letter from NorCal from several years ago. We have here a letter dated February 20, 2004. You must be referring to some previous letters. I'd like to get a copy of that distributed also. So between the two of you guys, we could get that. That's
Representative Anderson, and then Ogg again.
I'll pass.
Representative Ogg.
And I'm not sure who could answer this. You, Representative Anderson, or you, sir. Through the chair, just a question here, and we've gone through these in other cases, other bills that have been in front of us. And this goes to the area of intentional torts, which are reckless disregard, gross negligence, basically in the genre of intentional torts. Does this bill leave an exception for this, for those areas where you actually have bad actors?
I don't think this bill addresses that issue. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm. You know, I'm not completely familiar with all of the law.
Representative, I don't recall seeing either a place where that was addressed.
Well, I can just respond briefly. And we'll continue to get. We'll have another hearing on this next Wednesday, so you can get a more conclusive. But I think that when we dealt with this, when we were talking about home builders last week, House Bill 340, I think that those issues of actual misconduct, fraud, those types of things that would be licensure actions are dealt with by the medical board itself, the licensing board, and would probably be dealt with in a separate context. I don't see anything in this bill that would preclude you from bringing a separate cause of action with respect to those types of fraudulent or those types of, as you said, truly bad actors. But we should look into it between now and the next hearing to be sure of that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gera?
Yeah, I've read the bill. Oh, I'm sorry.
I appreciate that. And I just want to, because in one of the bills that we brought up, not the real estate one, but in the home builder's bill, we actually did put the except for language in, except for actions of that.
Mm-hmm.
And in the real estate one, we didn't quite get there. But I just want to make sure that we're not saying it's okay to be a bad doctor when we go down.
Could
this
I follow
road.
Up?
Thank would you, the, Madam Chair.
Would the association object if we put that specific exception in?
I don't believe so. I haven't spoken with my board, but I wouldn't believe so. But if I may respond too, I think that what we're getting into the area of not only disciplinary actions, as you mentioned, but I think also, Madam Chair, we're also dealing with the other areas of the general civil statutes dealing with punitive damages. I think that's, I'm not an attorney, but that I think that's probably where the those issues are dealt with.
Madam Chair, this response. And
Representative Bob?
Unfortunately, the Judiciary Committee and some of us have that training a little bit. When you talk about punitives, that's a separate category from pain and suffering. And I just want to be sure that if somebody is acting bad, that they're liable for the pain and suffering.
Well, and don't forget, too, Representative Ogg, just for the record, that House Bill 340 was meant to be an exclusive limit on all causes of action based on the certain actions that were derived. So it would have been everything. That's the reason why we went back and said, except in those cases of gross negligence, recklessness, and intentional disregard. So I think what we're saying here is a little different. We're talking about non-economics, not even compensatory, and definitely not punitive. So, Representative Gera?
Madam Chair, just to respond to Representative Ogg's question, I did look into it as I was reading through the bill and reading through the statutes, and this bill as written would impose the $250,000 cap on pain and suffering damages, even in cases of reckless and intentional conduct. If it was reckless conduct. If it was intentional conduct and amounted to something like fraud and it wasn't a malpractice claim, there would be an argument that this cap wouldn't apply. But certainly recklessness. The question on intentional, I had the same question myself.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Jordan.
I will give these to Vanessa. Okay.
I'm going to give a list of the people I'm going to call the next three, so I'll do them in lists of three so that folks can be prepared. I'm going to go next to Dr. Alex Malter, and then after that I'm going to go to Dr. George Rainier, and after that to Dr. John Detty. So welcome, and if you'll just state your name, even if most of us know you, your name and your affiliation for the record.
Madam Chair, House Judiciary Committee members, my name is Alex Malter, and I'm an internist in private practice here in Juneau, and also have the privilege of representing the State Medical Association this year as its current president. I'm going to reiterate a few of the points that our executive director made, but before I do, I wanted to touch base on some of the questions that you all raised. Representative Gary, you raised the question whether this letter from an attorney might have been somewhat inflammatory. And I suppose I can see why you might have interpreted it that way. But just for the record, I can tell you that my practice has changed since these decisions came down. Again, now we're referring to these O'Malley decisions that talked about giving informed consent or perhaps not giving quite as much informed consent in the middle of the night, even though this physician recommended that that the patient go to the emergency room. The physician still lost on that case. So I'm not a lawyer, and I apologize if I missed some of the subtleties of your questions. However, based on what I've read from not just the attorney's letter that you're referring to, but from correspondence from my malpractice carrier, and based on what I've heard about this case, I have changed my practice. And now when I get calls in the middle of the night, whereas I used to really try hard to keep my patients from going to the emergency room if I thought that they really didn't need to go, now I lean the other direction. And unless I think that it's completely clear cut that a person does not need to go in, now I much more quickly strongly recommend that folks go in and begin listing this litany of concerns about what might happen if they didn't go in. I actually think it's unfortunate that it's come to this. You know, as a physician, it's easy to send everybody to the emergency room. What's harder, and what I'm really getting paid for, is sitting in my office and deciding who doesn't need to go into the emergency room, who might have a chest pain. That's why the system isn't going broke, is because we're sitting around and figuring out who we don't need to spend, who we don't need to hospitalize, even though they're having a little bit of chest pain. And that's what I really consider myself getting paid for. And unfortunately, after this case, even though I try and be cognizant of these issues all the time, you know, spending, you know, all of our funds, I've gotten to the point where I'm much quicker to send my patients in. Another point that was brought up in the questioning was the question of salaries, and perhaps our salaries higher in Alaska to go along with higher rates of malpractice premiums. And I'm not an expert in that area. I can just tell you anecdotally that a year ago I was considering looking around at different practices in different states. And all the offers I got were higher salaries than I'm making here. So I don't want to extrapolate too much from that, other than to say that I think that it's perhaps a little simplistic to presume that salaries in Alaska are so much higher than they are anywhere else. And then thirdly, the question of can we expect a decrease in rates of the malpractice premiums? And what I'm going to talk about a bit more in my testimony or in my written testimony is that this issue is not about simple rates of malpractice premiums. The issue, malpractice premiums in Alaska are somewhat high, but they're currently they're not as terrible as they are in a few states in the country. That's not the issue. The issue is that we want to develop a very healthy, strong malpractice liability insurance market, a market that doesn't, you know, encourage other insurers from stepping out, doesn't encourage two out of the four big insurers in the state and pulling out in a year. And does not and is attractive when physicians consider coming to work here. So with that, I'm going to go on and begin some prepared testimony, and of course I'll answer questions at the end as well. As I mentioned, I am the current president of the State Medical Association. Asthma represents physicians statewide and is primarily interested in assuring that Alaskans receive high-quality health care. I'm here today to express asthma's support of House Bill 472 and to urge each of you to support the bill as well. The medical liability reforms the bill establishes are important to Alaskans for a variety of reasons. I expect others to testify, as Jim has done, and I expect others to come online and testify that House Bill 472, for example, will help stabilize the professional liability market and by so doing effectively temper future increases in federal and state expenditures on healthcare delivery, because as you recall, the Medicare rates and the Medicaid rates are in part influenced by malpractice costs. Similarly, I expect others to testify from Fairbanks, for example, how when a couple of malpractice insurers pull out of the state, it's devastating to big groups of physicians, and it potentially creates a crisis when physician groups come within a few days of completely losing their liability coverage. I'm going to concentrate my remarks, however, on explaining how strong medical liability reform will be critically helpful in recruiting and retaining enough well-trained physicians to provide for the future needs of health. Access to healthcare services is really precariously limited in this state. Alaska has one of the smallest, if not the smallest, number of physicians per capita in the country. A January 19, 2004 American Medical News article that Mr. Jordan referred to, which was pertaining to the Medicare payment rates for Alaska, noted the crisis in the workforce. Quote, Alaska has long ranked among the worst states in terms of physician supply. In 2002, the state had fewer than 1,350 doctors in private practice and another few hundred in military or other government posts. The state has a population of 644,000. Only six states had a lower doctor-to-patient ratio. The article went on to identify Idaho as the state with the worst physician shortage, estimating that state had one non-government physician for every 544 patients. However, our association's own 2002 database, which we believe is more accurate than the database used in the article, showed only 1,115 physicians in private practice in the state, or approximately one physician per 578 patients. Thus, it seems very probable that for 2002, Alaska actually had the lowest physician-to-patient ratio in the country. Updated calculations based on 2003 numbers indicate that this is almost certainly still true, with one physician per 553 patients. By comparison, the state would need about 50% more practicing physicians to approach the national average of one doctor per 360 patients. Further exacerbating the problem, Alaska's physician workforce is relatively old compared to the rest of the country. The Asthma Association's database shows that over half the state's practicing physicians are older than 51 years, setting up a looming recruitment crisis. The scenario was corroborated by the State Medical Board. There was a September 2002 Anchorage Daily News article entitled Shingle Shortage. Finally, the Providence Hospital study that Mr. Jordan referred to confirms that this workforce is aging and highlights immediate shortages in certain specialties in Anchorage, including general internal medicine, psychiatry, and general surgery, amongst others. So it's because of this imminent recruiting challenge that the medical liability reform is so critically important to Alaska right now. The state does not have the capacity to grow its own physicians, as Mr. Jordan pointed out. We have no medical schools. The small number of students who graduate from the WAMI program, some of them don't even come back to return in the state. And likewise, our lone family practice residency program is quite small. Alaska is and will continue to be a net importer of doctors. As such, we're competing with other states that have a physician shortage, and the competition is largely influenced by the state's medical practice environment. A recent American Medical Association study of medical students found that the legal environment and the availability of affordable medical liability insurance plays a major part in a graduate's decision as to where they want to set up practice. Alaska needs to optimize its medical legal environment to help us recruit the doctors we're going to need, the doctors we do need as well. That's why the Alaska State Medical Association supports House Bill 472. With its $250,000 cap on non-economic damages, the bill provides the gold standard liability reforms that will help create the healthy practice environment so important to physician recruitment. asthma understands that medical liability reform is only one element in developing a healthy environment. Still, because this legislature and the state has already had the foresight to enact other important medical practice reforms, we believe liability reform is the most critical remaining element. Indeed, we are pleased to have been able to help the state reach this point through our recent work on other important legislation, including the Alaska Patients Bill of Rights, prompt pay legislation, physician joint negotiation legislation, and federal Medicare payment reforms targeted to Alaska. ASMA has even offered its own ideas to the current administration regarding strategies by which the state could actively market the state of Alaska to out-of-state physicians. So as a result of those previous and the current ongoing efforts, ASMA believes that except for strong medical liability reform, the practice environment here in the state is actually quite favorable. Finally, I'm going to wrap up. I'd like to point out that in the gallery today are Dr. Jeannie Bonner, ASMA's immediate past president, and Dr. Paul Worrell, the association's president-elect. And I simply point out their attendance because, along with mine, their being here today demonstrates that ASMA's past and present and future are all committed to working to help attract well-trained physicians to the state. So I appreciate your attention. I will certainly answer any questions that I can.
Thank you. Dr. Malter, I don't know if you're the person to ask about this, but I know that there was a point in Alaska's young history back in the late 60s, early 70s, where we didn't have medical malpractice insurance. We didn't have it. It wasn't even a choice. And so what the state had to do is step up to the plate and form a risk pool. And if you could tell the committee a little bit about that, I don't remember all the details, but I want people to understand and be clear about something. With two main providers left, and of those two, a hesitance in some cases, you'll hear testimony, if you haven't already in your personal conversations, from some groups, cardiology groups, for example, that didn't know that they were going to get their medical malpractice reissued until a couple of hours before the policy was going to expire. Just understand that whatever policy choice you come up with, realize the consequences. Recognize that if it's true we don't mitigate the risk and these folks leave, that be ready as a state to come back into the position of forming that risk pool, because obviously it would be irresponsible to allow doctors to operate without medical malpractice insurance. It's the law in the state of Alaska that they do. So if you could just tell the committee a little bit about that.
I appreciate that, and there might be others who can give some more details, but I'll take a crack just initially and then let Jim and some other folks who are talking perhaps give input as well. But Representative McGuire is completely correct. My partner was around when this crisis became to the fore in Alaska a number of years ago, and hearing his descriptions of it, it was really a terrible situation when the doctors who wanted to practice here and wanted to be covered so that if they did make mistakes, their patients could get recompense, had no options to get liability coverage. At that point, the state put together a pool, and I suspect many of you are more familiar with it than myself, but it takes a lot of money for the state to capitalize that pool. It has been estimated that if the situation became worse here and it got to the point where there were not enough carriers, or if the last carriers pulled out, if the state had to step up to the plate, it would be extremely expensive, scores of millions of dollars, as I understand it, just to get started putting together the backing to offer medical liability broadly. So again, I'll defer to my colleagues, but from my layperson's understanding, it behooves the state as well, the state government as well, to have a very strong medical malpractice market in place, because if that market dissolves with one other carrier pulling out, it gets dumped in the state's lap, and that's very expensive to the state. A related issue is that when two out of the four big medical malpractice carriers pulled out this year, you might think, well, there were still two carriers riding coverage. Well, in fact, that's not exactly completely true, because one of the two carriers that was left was very limited in the number of new policies that they could write because of state requirements for background or secondary insurance or reinsurance. So NorCal, was really very limited in being able to step up to the plate, and they were only able to take on a very modest number of the physicians that were left bare when the first two carriers pulled out. And because of that, the last remaining insurer was effectively almost a monopoly for a month or two while physicians were getting coverage. Now, thankfully, the physicians who got coverage did not feel that they were taken advantage of by this monopolistic, this near monopolistic situation. But, you know, I would hate for you to think, well, there were still two left. I mean, it was just very close, just very recently, to being to the point where there was only one carrier left. And not to be presumptuous, but I strongly suspect that if this were dumped back in the state's lap, it would be a huge headache for you all. Mr. Jordan, would you add? Would you want to add? Excuse me, Chair. I don't mean to.
Mr. Jordan?
If I might, just for the record, the capitalization for the Medical Indemnity Corporation of Alaska was $9 million, and that was in the mid-70s. And it's the amount of capitalization that a company has as well as its surplus that determines how much that it can write. And Dr. Malter was absolutely correct. It was a crisis situation, and it was during that time when there were a number of physician-owned insurance companies that began, one of which is MIAC, which I mentioned earlier, and they came into the marketplace here during that crisis. So there would be multiple insurance companies here.
Representative Gira?
Thanks, Dr. Malter. I have an understanding. I just want, I appreciate it if you would tell me if you have a different understanding, because I don't know if I'm right. There's been an unintended suggestion by the bill sponsor and I think yourself. I think the unintended suggestion is that the two carriers that recently left because of high malpractice liability exposure. But my information is that's not why they left. Do you have any information as to why those companies left?
No.
And let me just tell you my information, and you can then come back to me at some point. Tell me if I'm wrong.
We can get that information to you.
The information I have on CNA, but please correct me if I'm wrong, is that CNA essentially stopped writing malpractice insurance coverage nationwide. That may be wrong. And then I don't know why the other one left, but I suppose it would be relevant information.
We can, perhaps my colleagues can get you, can answer that right now. But again, the concern is we all know that this has been a crisis nationwide, or that in certain states it's more of a crisis than others. But, you know, in important states, big states, Florida's, Pennsylvania's, this has really reached a crisis. Again, we don't mean to suggest that our goal is to, you know, get premium rates low and then more people. Our main concern with this entire legislation is that by setting a cap, the insurance companies have a better idea of what their future risks are going to be, and it creates a market that's more attractive to them to enter, and therefore creates a healthier environment for physicians to practice and to recruit new physicians.
Fair enough. Just to follow up on that point.
Representative Garen, follow up?
And I think that makes sense. I think maybe they do need a hard cap rather than a soft cap like the one we have, right? I mean, I suppose the soft cap, the way it works is, I suppose if they don't know whether you might live another 100 years, the soft cap can keep going up unless you had a firm guess on what everybody's life expectancy would be.
Mr. So, Jordan, I see you nodding. When appropriate, come up to the mic.
Would you be supportive at all if we did some sort of two-tiered hard cap thing, which is a lower damage cap for pain and suffering and loss of enjoyment of life along the lines of what's being suggested here, but a higher one if the injury is lifelong debilitating or involves severe disfigurement or significant paralysis or something like that? Would that be something if they were both hard caps that you might be able to support?
Well, again, I'd have to come back to my board, but my expectation is that the rest of my board would not be comfortable with that. While I understand, I think, where you're going with the question, the experience is that in the states that have the single hard cap, that the medical malpractice liability market is healthier. And all we can do is, you know, use experience from other states to, you know, try and come up with statutes that will help create the healthiest malpractice market here. So My anticipation is that we wouldn't be comfortable with that, although I can't speak for my entire board.
Mr. Jordan?
I was just, for the record again, this is Jim Jordan. I just wanted to add a factual comment about CNA. CNA did not drop out of the entire market. They're the largest writer of medical liability insurance for physicians in the state of Idaho. And I believe that you may hear some testimony, I think maybe from Dr. Reinier in regards to
Northwest. He's up next. Representative Ogden, then Gruenberg.
Yes, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. One, and there might be a couple back and forth in the area of physicians per population. And one I'd like to, if you could supply, how many physicians we have in the state, and probably don't have it, say from 1995 until the present on a yearly basis. And I hope that the number you gave us, did that include the 1350 or 1304? Did that include governmental or quasi-governmental, such as Native healthcare doctors, too?
Yeah, that's a good question. That 1300 number was estimates from the National Association, and we have we think that our numbers are better. Our numbers show that the 1,115 doctors were in private practice. 1,115 doctors were in private, and I'll provide these numbers to you as well in my testimony. I'll give you copies of my testimony. But 1,115 doctors are in private practice. There are 645,000 folks in the state. So doing the calculation, you end up with approximately one physician per 570 or 580 patients. And those are the same calculations that are done when the National Association is comparing states. They're looking at private practice physicians versus the physicians in a state. So while it may seem like the numbers are not completely parallel, we believe that the comparisons that we're making to other states are as accurate and as valid as they can be.
I would appreciate that, but I also would like to have you include sort of the governmental things, because in this state we do have a different system than almost any other state in the nation, and I think that would help me understand that figure a little better.
We do have some information. Yeah, we can provide that information for you. The numbers, it turns out, we'll provide that information for you. Yeah.
Dennis, Madam Chair, the second area is just sort of observation a little bit, but sometimes it's easy. You can, our profession, what you say, our average age here is 51, and we're not getting recruitment. And that looks, you know, well, that's an interesting thing, and you start to wonder why. Why might that be? But having served on a few boards and having dealt with lots of different issues and different types of employment, and over the last 3 or 4 years, my observations are that this is not just strictly limited to the medical profession, that in the fishing industry, I think you'll probably find that the age of the average permit holder is probably somewhere around where you're talking about, and that the recruitment into the fishing industry on permits other than IFQs, ones that have great value, you can't recruit people into it. The workers on the North Slope, although it's a different type of profession, the same thing, they're reaching that age, and maybe there is recruitment into that. And I'm not sure about the other professions, but I think it goes across the spectrum. And so what you're seeing in your profession probably doesn't differ than what's happening in the state as a whole. And I'm just querying, just out there, is maybe we're just not that an attractive environment in our present fiscal state for people to come here.
Madam Chair, I appreciate what you're getting at. I think, though, that the analogy between the fishermen is a little bit problematic in the sense that, well, if there aren't quite as many, with the fear of offending anybody, if there aren't quite as many fishermen, there might be, you know, there might not be some more fish in the sea for the next year. The problem with physicians is a little bit dissimilar, or is dissimilar. If there aren't physicians, there are people to be seen. There are people who need medical care. So I would contend that, you know, such a significant dearth of physicians is potentially more problematic to the state and the public health of the state and to the safety of the state than a dearth of fishermen.
Sure. Madam Chair, I don't think I've been
here in
that
Vaught?
Conversation. I guess I'm just trying to get a better global understanding of what's going on. And we do focus a lot here on the fiscal woes and the decreasing monies that go to education. And I would think that perhaps somebody in your field who wanted to come here would look at all those parameters and say, maybe another place is better. And maybe that is a factor that's driving this also, besides what you're proposing, that it's focused on the facts that we have this liability issue. That's where I would.
Well, and I think it's probably a combination of a variety of factors that come into play, you know, with respect to our remoteness, the fact that we don't have a medical school. We try hard with WAMI, but we're down to 10 slots there. And of those 10, not all return. So I think it's an overall package, but what we're trying to focus on here, and I don't think it should be without a focus on the other things. I have a commitment to looking at how we could up our number of WAMI students, for example, but it's going to take a lot of negotiation with the University of Washington because those spots really aren't for sale right now, unfortunately. But I would be willing to work with you on other fronts, too, because I think it's a big problem, as Dr. Malter has indicated. Our average, you know, over 50% of our doctors are over 50 years old. And it's going to be a big problem, especially in rural areas. You know, OBGYNs, just getting somebody to deliver your baby anymore is a real tough problem. So what we're trying to focus on here today is part of probably a three-legged or maybe even four-legged chair rather than a three-legged stool. But we're trying to do what we can. And again, one of the big problems, there are no guarantees. Representative Guerra and I have talked about this, and he asked that question in every tort reform hearing that we've had so far. You know, what proof do you get or what guarantee can you get from the insurance companies that they'll either lower their rates or expand their coverage? Of course, we can't, as a government, guarantee that. So all we can do is try to reduce our exposure and hope that we'll continue to remain attractive enough to keep at least the two carriers or one and a half carriers and potentially attract some more. So I think you're right, Representative Vaught, it's a much bigger problem. I don't think anyone here believes this is the only solution. So, Representative Gruenberg, and then Guerra.
My brief question was exactly along this line, whether maybe some of the people are leaving because they want to be in a situation where they're under an HMO or something like that, or they're Medicaid-related or whatever, or maybe the physician population is aging and they just are ready to retire. I think that it would be really a good idea, either through the medical association. Let me ask you, is this what we call an integrated medical association, like an integrated bar where everybody has to join? Oh, okay. Maybe something that could be done would be some kind of a survey, either directly or through the Division of Occupational Licensing, to find out, maybe with a professional pollster, why, you know, with the level of job satisfaction and why they're leaving and what'll it take, you know, because if the population is going down, that means three things are happening. I mean, people are dying here, docs. They're leaving and they're not coming in. What it takes to attract people to come in. I was talking this afternoon with one of the justices on the Supreme Court, and he was saying that when people finish clerking for the court, they can get jobs that are very lucrative in the legal field. And I'm wondering if maybe Alaska just doesn't have as much money for the docs as in other areas of the country. You want to say anything about that?
Sure, just briefly.
What question was it?
Well, Madam Chair, if I might, I think Mr. Jordan pointed out that the biggest determinant probably of where folks practice is residency slots, where they did their residency. There's one relatively small residency in this state. It's not enough to supply all of our needs. So for better or for worse, the state needs to import physicians because, you know, having 50% fewer physicians per capita is probably not good. It probably portends that the folks here might not be getting quite such high quality care because of that. So if unless you want the state to get worse, for you know, unless we want that number to get worse, we have to import folks. Our loan residency program is not going to do it. Now, your chairwoman made the point that we're somewhat constrained in what we can do, but one thing we can do is make the practice environment so conducive that at least it won't turn anybody off from coming up here because they could go to California where there's less worries about litigation. That's we only have so many things in our control, and I think that's a good point.
You know, if I may,
Representative Gruenberg, and
you know, other things that we might consider, there's the student loan program, and that can be helpful, and maybe it could be used in the medical field, for example, even if you're not an Alaska resident, but you enter into a binding agreement to practice up here, you could be eligible for an Alaska student loan.
I understand that. Those ideas have been batted around. Jim, I don't, Mr. Jordan, I don't have, Madam Chair, if I might defer to Mr. Jordan.
No, it's just, we don't need to talk about it here. We have limited time. But you people, and I know, by the way, I should disclose that my own doctor, Dr. Bonner, who's a great doc, by the way, and you people all are used to very creative solutions. You think outside the box. You've got to help your patients survive, as I know, and I think maybe I've either Dr. Sonneborn, his partner, certainly on the line. Help us come up with some creative solutions. Let's solve the problem.
As noted, we have gone to the administration to give them some ideas of ways of getting folks recruited up here. We're trying to do that.
Would you be willing to share them with legislators?
Yes. Briefly.
We can do that.
Well, we can. Why don't you do that? If Madam Chair, if I could ask, if you'd be willing to send us on the committee, and maybe even folks off the committee, why cut them out? Copies of your suggestions.
We'll
Let's
be happy
work
to.
Together.
Sure. Well, you brought up Dr. Bonner's name. We want to acknowledge her. I don't see her on the testimony list, but I just got a thing in the mail that showed that you won the Rose Award for the American Diabetes Association. So congratulations.
That's
exciting. It's a big honor. Done a lot of work with diabetes patients.
That's why she's the chairman. I congratulated her privately, but you deserved a public congratulation.
Thank you very much.
Yes, I speaking for our organization, and that Dr. Rainier is online, I believe, to speak. And they covered the subject very well. And the subject that Representative Gruenberg is speaking about the problems with the doctors up here and
Dr. Barner, are you going to pull your chair just a little bit?
Yes, the subjects, I think that's off the subject that we are talking about today, but it is something that both all the legislatures need to address at some point, you know. So thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I guess I should probably disclose that these doctors saved my life, so probably I have a conflict.
Or we do.
Yeah.
Maybe you'd rather than I.
Okay, well, thank you, Dr. Malter. Representative Gary, you have a question? Okay. Thank you, and I'm going to go next now to Dr. Rainier, then to Dr. Duddy, as I said before, then to Dr. Mark Withrow from Kodiak, and then to Dr. Cobden from Tanana Valley Clinic. So next is Dr. George Rainier, and Dr. George Rainier is on the off-net. Can you hear us, Dr. Rainier?
Yes, yes I can. Madam Chairman and the members of the Judiciary Committee, can you hear me all right?
We can.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify regarding House Bill 472. I'm a cardiologist. I've been practicing here since 1971. And I'm a founding member of the Alaska Heart Institute and also a board member of Alaska Physicians and Surgeons. I encourage you to also favor this legislation, which is about access to medical care. And to look back at the past, a study of the present, and I think a peer into the future will tell you why it's a good idea. When I started practice in 1971, there was no heart program. I and my partner, Jim Balla, started it. We got the first cardiac catheterization laboratory going in Anchorage. I did the first angiogram and learned how to do the first angioplasty. We organized the heart surgery program back in 1973. And other physicians likewise were attracted to Alaska because of the opportunity in this great state. to make a difference and to make a good living and to live in a wholesome place to raise a family. There was no problem finding good health, an office, good hospitals to practice in, and obtaining malpractice insurance. In fact, malpractice insurance was sort of an afterthought. My first annual premium was only $80 a year. But because Alaska was attractive to physicians, we have all enjoyed a remarkable improvement in access to medical care here. Doctors have moved to the smaller communities. The larger cities have sophisticated services. There's neurosurgery, joint replacement, heart surgery, and other heart treatments of all sorts, pediatric intensive care units. In fact, you know that many of these services are really unmatched anywhere. We Alaskans no longer have to leave the state for medicine and surgery. But conditions are changing. As our technical ability to deal with serious illness improves, other circumstances are really worsening. We are aging. When you go to the operating room, you see older doctors. Many of us are nearing retirement age, and too few doctors are being trained nationally. Since we don't have an in-state medical school and only one residency program, as previously mentioned, we can't make our own very much. We have to import virtually all of them, and it is difficult to recruit physicians to Alaska for a number of reasons, some of which have been touched upon already this afternoon. My group, the Alaska Heart Institute, spends nearly $100,000 a year recruiting constantly, and we've always been behind. We really need every advantage to attract doctors. Now, a good legal climate for the practice of medicine is something you can provide. Without readily available malpractice insurance, our recruiting will be handicapped. Without new doctors, you can be sure that our citizens will have reduced access to care. We need replacement doctors to deliver babies, treat heart attacks, set bones, and everything that you know about. If our malpractice insurance climate worsens, getting young doctors to come here will be nearly impossible, and you can be sure that some Alaskans will go without medical care, even emergency care. Here in Alaska, we are very fortunate to be able to see into the future for medicine. Well, while we are really minute-to-minute up-to-date in medical treatment and technology, we've enjoyed being several years behind the social and business upheavals that are suffered by the medical community and residents in the lower 48. Managed care really is a good example of something we have avoided by anticipating it. Again, I think we can look south and plainly see Alaska's future. In the lower 48, we see loss of access to medical care by patients. In the lower 48, we see physicians marching on state capitals. Looking down there, we see mass physician migrations, and we see early retirement and crisis legislation. These events, I think, have been created by legal climates, which make it so difficult for insurance companies to predict losses. They could no longer continue in the medical malpractice business. Many companies have left the business financially and locally for that reason. Some remaining in business require premium payments to physicians so high as to approach the physician's annual take-home pay. Here in Alaska, our insurance premiums are very high, as mentioned already. But more importantly, we now have very few companies even offering us insurance. The remaining two are mutual companies owned by physician policyholders. Most live in California. Last year, Northwest Physicians Mutual, the company who provided insurance for us, canceled our policy and left the state due to high losses. And to answer Representative Guerra's question, they asked for a 100% increase in their premiums, and this was denied by the Division of Insurance, so they felt that they could not stay here and left. Another stock company did the same thing to the large clinic in Fairbanks. Of the two companies actively now doing business in Alaska, one could not provide the limits we needed, thus leaving only one company left. These remaining companies are facing the same legal climate that forced the others out. If they leave, virtually all of us will be without insurance. Some younger physicians will probably continue to practice bare, that is, without coverage. Many of the older physicians will be forced into involuntary early retirement. I think this would be a monumental catastrophe, and you have the power to prevent it. Someone suggests that the state could step in and form another insurance company like they did in the 1970s, MICA. This company, unfortunately, would face the same problems, and it would cost millions to establish. It's crystal clear we now need a legislative solution. We've had changes in tort law over the years. These modifications have not completely ameliorated the problem, however, which admittedly is in part a societal one. But the one legal feature that discriminates states with a stable malpractice experience from those who do not have is the $250,000 cap on non-economic damages. I support this. I know that the increase from $80 to $20,000 a year per year for my insurance is due to a lot of causes. It is not due to an increase in the rate of malpractice suits. You are faced, I think, with a trade-off. Place a limit on the amount an individual can get for pain and suffering, and in return, help ensure that all Alaskans continue to have physicians available to provide the medical care that they need and desire. Thank you very much, and I can entertain questions.
Thank you, Dr. Rainier. We appreciate your testimony. And just as an aside, for the doctors that are online, please feel free to go ahead and have a speakerphone on hold or something with a staff member nearby or even just out there, and we can get back to you if you're practicing. We don't want to hold you up today, so feel free to do that. And I will take testimony next Wednesday, so if you run into problems today, feel free to come back on Wednesday, and we can take your testimony at that time.
Yeah, yes, Madam Chairman. I will probably have to leave shortly, but if there are questions that I can particularly answer, I can do that now.
Thank you, Dr. Rainier. Representative Guerra.
Thanks, Dr. Rainier. This is Les Guerra speaking. You sort of faded out at the end, and I could hear that your malpractice insurance rates have gone up, and I could hear that you thought they either had gone up or had not gone up because of a rise in malpractice suits. Can you just address that again?
Yes, Representative Guerra. The company that we were with, Northwest Physicians Mutual, is a mutual company based in Oregon. We've been with them for 5 or 6 years, as were many Alaskan physicians. And they, from time to time, and I was on their advisory board, they, from time to time, would publish data for us showing that the amount of suits filed and settled or paid out, so to speak, had remained about the same. The actual cost per claim to settle and or to pay the claim was going up exponentially. So over the years, apparently there has not been an increase in the number of malpractice suits taken to court, filed, or settled. It's just that the cost per claim has been a major effect here.
Representative Guerra?
Sure. And do you know if the amount of money being paid to the plaintiffs has been going up, or if a portion of that, or if that has to do with defense costs? Do you have any idea?
Yes, they show that it was in part defense costs, a large portion of it was actually settled. Claims paid to the plaintiffs, but they. Obviously, the cost for defending the cases where it's going into, just like the cost of all kinds of legal businesses.
Okay. And I'd certainly be appreciative if you could get any of that information to me.
I certainly will try to get that from Northwest Physician.
Thank you.
Okay, any further questions for Dr. Rainier? Not. Thank you, Dr. Rainier, for your patience and your insight.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so next, I am going to go to Dr. John Duddy, and I'm told that Dr. Mark Withrow is no longer online. Is that true? In Kodiak? Okay, so Dr. John Duddy, and then in light of that, we'll go next to Dr. Richard Comden. Dr. John Duddy first, and then Dr. Comden.
Thank you. For those of you who don't know me, I'm John Duddy, Dr. Duddy. I am an orthopedic surgeon practicing in Anchorage since 1999. I came from the Ohio State University, where actually I was planning on staying on staff at Ohio State and was offered a position there. My senior partner, Dr. Mike Newman, recruited me. He spent about 2 years at that time, back in 1997, trying to find a position to come up here, and wasn't very successful until he hired a recruiting company. Prior to that interview with Dr. Newman, I really expected to stay in Columbus, Ohio and work at Ohio State. That all changed after I visited Alaska. I mean, we all know and we all love this state for its beauty, both its natural beauty as well as hard-driving individuals, I found a place, the practice environment in Alaska to be exceptional. While practicing physicians in the Midwest were complaining about malpractice insurance rates and availability of malpractice, physicians I spoke with on my several trips up to Alaska were always upbeat and happy. This was a marked change from my experience in Ohio. After I moved to Alaska, the practice environment remained relatively stable from 1999 until 2001 or 2002. The practice environment began to change about 3 years ago. About that time, the AMA, as we've heard, declared that Alaska was at risk, an at-risk state with respect to potential for malpractice crisis. Very few practicing physicians, including myself at that time, noticed the gradual change until May of 2003 when my malpractice insurer, Northwest Physicians Mutual Insurance Company, notified me that me and all the other physicians insured with that company were no longer going to, they were never going to issue policies in Alaska. This was a wake-up call for many physicians in Alaska. Fortunately, the relatively few number of physicians that were insured through Northwest Mutual, and at that time, MIC was willing to write new policies, so my practice was able to obtain coverage or maintain coverage. I suspect if my associates or I had pending lawsuits or past suits, we may not have been able to obtain malpractice coverage, even with MIEC, at that time one of the only two carriers left in the state. In the last year, the loss of all the malpractice carriers except for two has had a direct negative impact on my ability to recruit new physicians. My group has been attempting to bring up two physicians for the last couple years. We were able to get one two years ago, but we've had a great deal of difficulty since that time. And the word on the street in the lower 48 is that Alaska is now becoming a very unfavorable environment to practice. In fact, the neurosurgeons, there's only three of them, as we know, in the state. They've been actively, aggressively recruiting for the entire 5 years that I've been up here, and they've been unsuccessful in attracting any new neurosurgeons. Not only is it becoming difficult to attract new physicians or currently practicing physicians to the state, but if a crisis develops, many of the practicing physicians, as we've heard, will retire early. My senior associate, Dr. Newman, will certainly retire early if malpractice insurance is not available. Therefore, the combination of diminished ability to attract new physicians with potential loss of a large fraction of physicians only compounds the problem of the physician shortage that Jim Jordan already spoke regarding in the state. Some officials in the AMA, the American Medical Association, feel that Alaska is less than 1 year away from such a crisis. If this crisis occurs, the remaining physicians would certainly limit the practice. Certain high-risk procedures, such as spine surgeries, which I do, and traumas, would be sent south to Seattle. We see templates for this in the lower 48, where the Nevada lost all of their trauma physicians, and they were sending all their traumas to California. And you know, since we don't have a state right next to us, it's going straight to Seattle. Mm-hmm. We have a chance as a group to avert this crisis in Alaska. We know it's only a matter of time before the crisis that is affecting the states without medical liability reform in the lower 48 will affect Alaskans. I feel that physicians support H. Bill 472.
Thank you very much, Dr. Duddy.
Thank you,
ma'am. There any questions, Mr. Duddy? Okay. We thought Dr. Newman had already retired, so.
No, he's still around.
Good news.
I'm here.
Hi, Mike. Okay, thank you very much. Next, we are going to go to Dr. Richard Cobden at the Tanana Valley Clinic. Are you there?
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to say a few words on 472 and meeting most of you when I came down last week. And I'm not going to reiterate most of what has already been said, because it's all been said very well. But I'm a practicing orthopedist in Fairbanks, I represent Tana Valley Clinic, which has 29 providers, and Alaska Healthcare Network, which has 53, which is an organization of physicians and Fairbanks, and also the Alaska Orthopedic Association. But I'll speak for all three when I say that this is an important bill, and it will help us all to keep and recruit new doctors, as has been already said. The experience with Tana Valley Clinic and with Alaska Healthcare Network is rather dramatic because we were covered by CNA until late last year. On December 1st, we got a notice saying that they would no longer be servicing policies in the state of Alaska after January 1st, 2004, and we would have to seek coverage elsewhere. Also, they rather pulled the rug out from under us by saying that they would not be doing tail coverage for many of the physicians that they had previously promised, except at exorbitantly high rates. We had to do a lot of scrambling, but by the end of December, we were able to find NorCal and MIEC to make up the slack, and all the physicians were covered. But we came within 3 days of 41 physicians not getting any coverage at all. And under the rules and regulations of our hospital, they would not be allowed to practice at all in the hospital. That would have been a disaster. It represents about half of the physicians practicing in Fairbanks. So they told us when we asked them, CNA, that the reason they're pulling out was because of anticipated loss experience, whatever that means in insurance jargon, because we had not had any lawsuits in our clinic. We were kind of surprised to see this coming up during the time that previous year with CNA. And we didn't know of any amongst the other 41 doctors except one that was pending. So there wasn't like an overwhelming number of suits coming through. But I think it's very much as Dr. Duddy had said, the numbers were not there, but the amount of loss per claim probably was. One of the things they cited was that there's an unfavorable atmosphere in Alaska for insurance, and they did not wish to continue it. Then further, we had notification from NorCal recently that they would very likely be raising our rates in the near future. They wouldn't say how much, but they said